Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Season 5 of And the Writer Is with your host, Ross Golan. Before I give my spiel, I want to acknowledge the music army that listens to this podcast every week. Since starting this, the And the Writer Is community has literally changed the history of the music business by helping pass the Music Modernization Act, gotten songwriters added to Album of the Year for the Grammys, and still is advocating for positive changes for our industry on a daily basis. So thank you and congrats. Now, as you know, I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special live events, or buy that merch, aka that hat I always wear, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. Today's podcast is brought to you by our friends at Bandzoogle. Built for musicians by musicians, you can use Bandzoogle's tools to easily design a website, an EPK, sell your music, merch directly to your fans, and it's commission-free. Bandzoogle also recently added a crowdfunding feature, which lets you crowdfund your next project commission-free. So think about it. Your fans want to help fund your album. You don't need a record deal anymore. You can just use Bandzoogle. So go to Bandzoogle.com, try it free for 30 days. Be sure to use the promo code ATWI, and you'll get 15% off your first year of any subscription. That's ATWI at Bandzoogle.com for 15% off of any subscription. Songwriters, think about your favorite hit song and what makes it an earworm. You could be the writer behind the next song that goes viral. Enter the 20th annual NSAI Song Contest presented by Martin Guitars and Strings and CMT. You could win several prizes, including the one-on-one mentoring session with L. King, myself, and fellow And the Writer Is producer Joe London. The lyric-only winner will score $2,000 cash and mentoring session with award-winning songwriter Tom Douglas, as well as other coveted prizes. Send in your best songs now through October 31st at nsai.cmt.com. Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Today's three-time Grammy Award-nominated artist and multi-platinum songwriter launched his career with a number one UK debut album and went on to win an ARIA, a Brit, an Ivor Novello for that very same work. His most recent release has gained over 2 billion collective streams, and now he sells out shows all over the world, from Glastonbury to Saturday Night Live. His newest single, Peer Pressure, features our good friend, Julia Michaels, and he's famously an all-around good chap. All the way from the small town of Hitchin, England, this writer is the only guest we've ever had that my wife fancies more than me. And the writer is James Bay.
I feel like I need to sort of walk out into a sports field after that. Yeah. That was into like a baseball stadium. That was amazing.
If people saw the size of this room after that kind of intro, they'd be so sad. It's like we're doing this in the middle of Wembley, right? In the middle.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right? In humble Wembley, we are sat in a tent. So that sounds so it sounds better. Yeah. We're in a tent on the field.
Right in the middle of the pitch. Is that what it's called?
There you go, the pitch. You've nailed it.
I'm killing it. All right. So let's start in Hitchin.
Let's start in Hitchin.
How you pronounce it?
Hitchin, yes indeed.
Okay. How big is Hitchin? Where is Hitchin?
30,000 people.
Uh-huh.
And it's about an hour north outside of London.
Okay.
And it's really, with all love and respect to it, it's very kind of mundane, safe. It was a really sort of safe, chill place to grow up as a kid. I suppose the lucky thing for a kid growing up in Hitchin is, I was closer to London than a lot of the rest of the country. Like, it's like a 30-minute train ride and you're in. Yeah. Like, in the centre of London. And London's, there's a lot of stuff going on there, obviously. So it was great. It was a very chill place to be.
You have parents?
I have parents.
Did they do music?
No. But like lots and lots of parents, they are extremely passionate about music. And it was kind of straight down the line. Like, on the right side, my dad was obsessed with rock and roll, you know, everything that was kind of older rock and roll, from Chuck Berry through the Stones and Bruce Springsteen kind of and beyond. And my mum was all about soul music, and she loved Stax and Motown music and all those great artists. And so that music kind of resonated throughout the house a fair bit. And me and I have a brother as well. We got to really soak that up and fall in love with it from a pretty young age.
Is your brother a musician too?
He is. My brother's a musician. He's only 18 months older than me. So we grew up very close, and we were kind of obsessed with all the same things at all the same times. We were big into sports when we were kids, and we were also always big into movies and music. And I think, When you're close like that, if you have any interest in something, you have this kind of immediate support and interest from a second person. And something about that is fantastic, I got to say, just in my experience. If I'm curious about music or playing guitar or performing, he was too, and was doing his own version of it right next to me. And we were, you know, collaborating in one way or another from
Were you competitive?
Very early age. I personally, yes, I'm very competitive. My brother, slightly less so, but then again, we're brothers, so that's a whole different competition compared to the competition you might feel with the rest of the world. So I think he kind of is.
How so? I never had a brother. I have a sister. So we were competitive, but not really.
I don't know. We just were into all the same things, and we were competitive, but if I'm honest with you, so that's where the competition comes from, the fact that we're into all the same things and, you know, want to be better than each other at them. But as far as music goes, we always loved bands. We loved Mick and Keith, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards being this like team. And we were big into the Black Crowes, and the Robinson Brothers were this great team, this like famous musical team, and Lennon and McCartney and all of that stuff. So
did you guys write a lot together?
We did, yeah. When we were younger, we wrote a lot together. I played the guitar, and he didn't kind of bother with an instrument, because he naturally gravitated towards being the front man. He was obsessed with Mick Jagger and Rod Stewart and Chris Robinson and all those guys. Lots of the soul people, like James Brown, lots of the soul performers as well. He loved all of that and gravitated towards being front and center. And because he didn't have an instrument, you think about the way it lays out on a stage. Well, I'll be the guitar guy kind of at the side, because there'll be like a bass person who's at the other side. And so Alex would go in the middle and sing the songs. I guess I'd come up with the music, and we'd both kind of direct that. And he'd more often come up with the lyrics. I came up with some lyrics, but...
Why aren't you in a band? Why aren't you in the Black Crowes? Why aren't you in your version of like...
That's a great question, because I did that for years with my brother and other friends.
What was that called?
Oh, we were at one point the Jet Kings.
Oh, nice.
That was actually, which is as lame as that sounds, it was named after our guitar players, Ibanez Jet King 2, his electric guitar. So we just took that. We were Roadrunner.
How old were you guys when you guys started doing that?
We started doing that when we were 14. Okay, I was about 14 when I played my first show. And we'd been playing, me and my brother.
Were you doing covers or originals?
We were actually doing more originals than covers.
How old were you when you started writing?
Probably the same age, 13, 14. I remember one of the first songs that we wrote as a band.
What is it?
It was called It's Raining.
How does it go?
Well, it just was all about it's raining. And that's a real shame, because I wanted to go outside and play. It was genuinely like that childish.
Yeah.
But like, I don't know. That was what was
But now
that was what gave us the blues.
If you release that now, people will have so many metaphors attached to it. You know, they'll be like, "Yeah, it is raining outside, and I do want to go outside, and it's just too bad because it's depressing outside."
That's it.
I need to stay safe.
That's it.
You know,
that's the message maybe we were trying to convey, or maybe we were just trying to have anything to write about. Because
was it good?
It was okay. We played it at school, and everybody thought it was really good, and they didn't think it was ours. So
that's a huge.
That was a nice
boost.
Sign, yeah. in a way. But I guess why am I not in a band now? Because I was the one in the bands that we were in and in our little town, who kind of my attention span changed and moved on quicker than everybody else in the band. We were one version of a band, and then I was inspired by some other music, so I wanted to change it up a bit, and all the other guys in the band were kind of quite happy trying to just sound like the Rolling Stones or just sound like Kings of Leon, and I'd want to move it on, and then I the first thing I did was still a band, but that was me, was I just called it the James Bay Trio, and it was just me and a bass player and a drummer, and it was a little bit more kind of musical and less about the songs, and then I moved on again from that, and I would constantly just sort of change it up. And
were these side projects to, what do you call it, Roadrunner?
No, no.
You know, or like, were these considered side projects? Or were you like, you know what, guys?
I'm out and do the next thing.
I'm out.
Yeah, it was more that. The trio thing.
Did you
thing,
get support for that? Or was there like, oh, yo, you can't leave, you're my brother?
It was, no, my brother was actually great about it, really. Because strangely, I started to sort of move things on and then move into doing my own thing about 5 years after we'd started being a band. And it inspired him to do the same thing.
Oh, cool.
So he found that quite exciting, and we were able to do that. We were always, he and I were the creative force in whatever was going on. And when we kind of went in our little separate ways, we were both as inspired to do that thing. And then I went from even being in my little trio with a different bass player and drummer to just going all the way down to just me and an acoustic guitar. What's funny is I started my kind of musical life with more people around me, and it got smaller and less and smaller and less. And then it started again from me and acoustic guitar. And then I finally left Hitchin and I wandered off into the world and just with acoustic guitar and started to do it like that.
Do you miss being in a band, or do you enjoy the vulnerability of being solo?
I do enjoy the vulnerability of being solo. I get a little bit of the best of both worlds because I love playing and touring with a band behind me, and we get to play really loud and really fast, and it gets to feel a bit like Kings of Leon or the Stones or whatever, or Springsteen. It gets to feel a bit like that when I want it to. And then when I want it to, I get to kind of strip it all down. Sure. and go really kind of simple and do it like that.
How old were you when you left your, you know, Hitchin?
I was 19.
So you graduated high school. Did you
I
go
didn't.
To the, you didn't?
High school, yeah. I finished high school and then I went to university. You guys call university college?
Yeah.
Right. I went and did that, and I did about 18 months of that. And I was supposed to do 3 years, but
And that was the British and Irish Modern Music Institute.
I guess that's what they call it now. It's gone through a few names. It was just the British Institute of Modern Music back then. I don't think they had the Irish part yet. Right. There was just the Brighton. So yeah, it was. Well, no, back then it was the Brighton Institute of Modern Music on
the
South
Coast. So it was
in
Brighton?
Yeah, it was just out. Have you been?
I have. I went and it was, you know, it was really cold. You go on a beach town, and I was pretty excited to go, and it was
covered in stones,
freezing. It was
it's the worst beach you've ever seen in your life, right?
It's
coming from California.
Yeah, you know, I like New Jersey, but there are times of the year where if you went to Asbury Park and you walk on the boardwalk, where you'd be miserable too. And like, this is freezing.
I
Why
promise
would
you,
anyone live
I promise
here?
You there are 3 days in every year when Brighton Beach is phenomenal.
Yeah.
And that's it. Maybe two, like maybe 3 days every other year.
I caught one of the 362 days.
Yeah, that's a shame. Sorry about that.
So you went there and you just said, this isn't for me. I'm going to get out of here.
I went there and I think at best, and I learned all sorts of things there.
Like what?
I learned a lot of like real life stuff. Well, because it was like there was like classrooms and you had like assignments, and that was fine. But I was looking for a way into what I thought was the real kind of music industry and music world. So looking back, it was a great stepping stone. It kind of taught me that you can spend as much time as you like in a place like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the building that housed those classrooms was in the middle of a city that was full of bars and clubs and places to play. And the college was not going to get me into those bars and clubs, even though I was in the college in that city and all that. I had to do that myself. So it taught, so being there taught me that it's fine to be there and you know, have that going on, but whatever happens, you have to make some stuff happen for yourself. Wherever you might be at and whoever you might have around you, it's about your own kind of get up and go. It's about using that. So
somehow people don't realize how entrepreneurial being a musician is.
Yeah.
And when you get this, there's a cliche that about musicians where they say songwriters are struggling musicians. And you're like, no, 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 all people are struggling.
Absolutely.
And if you tried to start any business at any age, you'd be struggling.
Yeah.
You know, and this is a multi-billion dollar industry. Mm. So if it's hard to start your career in this, it's because it's hard to start a career in any industry.
Absolutely.
I think people just don't recognize that you actually have to go and do it, and that there's not this, it's not a talent search.
The funny thing is, you're absolutely right. I realized being down in Brighton that I thought I was arriving with like hundreds of like-minded people, and everybody loved music. Don't get me wrong. Everybody there loved music, but everybody's also got a different agenda. And I found out being around those people and being in that place that mine was what you were talking about. It was that, and it's like I've said, that sense of that get up and go sense of I have to do this for myself. And this sounds corny as well, but I have to believe in myself more than any of these people might. You know, as friendly as they are or not, I was out of my parents' house and in the real world a little more so. Yeah. And people will be with you and against you. And in all of that, you gotta love it enough and believe that you're great and that you're gonna change some people's minds and move some people. And
my assumption is your parents were supportive throughout this process, or you wouldn't be going to school.
That's very true. Yeah. The best thing I'll say, the best thing about how my parents were with my desire to be musical is that they didn't ever push me like so hard. Like, oh, okay, if you want to be a musician, well, you got to be rehearsing like all the time. What are you doing? You're not rehearsing. They didn't do that. They weren't that extreme, and they didn't say, "Don't be ridiculous. You can't have a life in music. That's silly." They just sort of sat right in the middle there and let me love it. And they liked to come to shows and sort of see that thing and watch their kids just enjoy being wild on stage and stuff.
When did you record first?
I think I was probably what version of recording? Because we bought me and my brother Alex and my oldest friend Tom, who is still my bass player in my band now, like today. He the three of us chipped in together for an 8-track recorder, like digital little box thing. It was a Zoom MRS-8, and which my brother still has. So we started messing around with that from like 13 or 14 years old, and making terrible recordings. We did that for years, and then we got some guy in town. In Hitchin, said he had a studio. We played around town all the time. We used to play a lot of our own material, and he was kind of inspired to invite us to his studio to record five or six of our songs. And that was when I was about 15 or 16 years old. So we went and did that. Didn't have a clue what we were doing. Tried to play live all in one take and do like loads of takes. And it was terrible, but I still love it to this day because it's, you know, it's one of my first
ever. Have you ever released it?
No way.
Really?
No, it's not that kind of thing. But I mean, I am proud of it though. And between us friends, we still have those recordings, and I haven't listened to them for a long time. But yeah, that was the first time we put something together.
I'm gonna have to hear that when this is done.
I have to find it.
It's in your phone, and you know it. You don't have to find it. You have a playlist that says like my early songs or something.
I feel like I should now.
Yeah, for sure.
There's a text or two I can send. I can get it in an instant.
Yeah, exactly. Well, considering Tom's your bass player,
absolutely.
My assumption is that
I'm sure he can do the same. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, how do you get from Brighton to Republic?
Right.
There's a gap from I'm not going to stay in this school for a second year.
Yeah.
To I'm going to sign with the biggest record company in the world.
Yeah. There's a few important moments in that. So the thing about these music colleges, which is wonderful, is that they are in touch with, or there are managers out in this world and A&R scouts that are They kind of have their finger on the pulse as much as possible. So they're in touch with these colleges and they're saying all the time, is there anything going on at the college? They get in touch with the college and they say, anybody we should come and see? And Paul, who sat with us here, and Ryan, who managed me together, they were just staying in touch with all these different colleges. And Ryan said to the folks down in Brighton, anybody we should come and check out? And they sent my MySpace page to Paul and Ryan.
Amazing.
Yeah, we're going back to the eighth, no. We're going back, though. We're going back far. Not quite the 80s, but we're going back far. And to when MySpace was still a thing.
When the other Tom was your friend, wasn't that the
guy? Right. Check that out. Absolutely. Yeah, they sent... there was one original song of mine on there.
What was it?
It was called Glow.
Okay.
I could probably find you that later.
All right. There you go.
And the next night, there was like a... not quite annual. They did these like biannual... shows that the college where like 20 you had to audition for these shows, and like 400 or 500 students would audition to get one of the 20 spots to perform on these nights. And I'd been lucky enough in previous ones to play, I think 3 or 4 times beforehand I played at these things. And there was one coming up that I hadn't auditioned for. I confess at this point, this is, I don't know if anybody's like knew this, I didn't audition, but the folks at the college were very smart and kind. And Paul and Ryan had said they wanted to come down and see me play. Was there anywhere I'd be playing? So they put me on, the people at the college put me on at this night to play one of my own songs. And Paul and Ryan came down and sat and watched it. And I guess it went okay. The song was not very good. It was a solid 2 out of 10 in my opinion. But
the song?
Yeah.
But the performance was obviously...
I hope so. Yeah, I guess so. Paul's smiling, so we're going to have to hope it was a good one. But I did that. And then me and Paul and Ryan went off to a bar and they just sort of said, look, we think you're great and we love what you're doing and we obviously respect that you're at this college and you can stick with that if you want. But they kind of wanted to put like an arm around my shoulder and kind of guide me along and help me out in any way that they could, and very much in a managerial way. And so it all started. I think as soon as they said that, I was like, okay, forget this college. I want to follow these guys into like the real music world, with all respect to the college. And we went from there, and I spent a couple of years writing and really working on writing and getting better at writing and sort of learning how to do all of that.
How were you getting better at writing?
I was trying co-writing. Actually, one of the things that really excited me about Paul and Ryan coming down is that I knew from a little bit of conversation that they'd had a lot of contact with co-writers, with like professional songwriters, and they worked with other artists of theirs with a lot of these songwriters. And I'd read hundreds and millions of sleeve notes where it might say, you know, it might list one of my favorite songs by James Morrison, but it's written by James Morrison, Martin Brammer, and like different writers, you know, and I was like, who are these guys? And they would tell me all about that. And so they introduced me to those types of people. And
who were some of those people?
Well, funnily enough, this dude Martin Brammer is a brilliant writer in the UK. They introduced me to a guy who's still one of my great friends in music called John Green.
John's great.
John is it? You know John?
Yeah.
Oh, what a dream! He's here right now this week. He's in LA. I'm seeing him tonight for dinner. He's one of my closest and greatest collaborators and friends. And a guy called Jamie Hartman, who works out of LA now. Sure. He's a brilliant dude. I actually, with those guys, with all the people I listed, I wrote some of the first songs that went on my first album. We're going back to 2011, 2012. And I collected a few songs, and I must have written hundreds of songs and managed to get 3 or 4 good ones. Because that's, you know, that's what it is. Like, we write lots of songs and maybe one of them every month or a few months is like a really good one. I guess that changes as you get better.
Sure.
At writing. But back then, that was what it was.
Did you have that gauge?
I was...
Like, did you know it wasn't good enough?
I was learning that. Well, I was really learning that. And there's one of the priceless things about having great managers is them quickly working out a way to be honest with you. And you being kind of big enough and I suppose grown up enough to take that and learn from it and move forward. If that can't work, there's a lot of things that can't work. It's a really important thing.
Were you always good at taking criticism?
I like to think so, but I tell you what, I like to think so because more than anything, I wanted to get ahead and I'm going to say succeed. It's a weird word to use, but more than anything, I wanted songs that more and more people wanted to hear and loved. And that means you've got to learn how to take criticism. because I can write you a song in a day on my own, even, because there's also, you know, there's all sorts of weird, strange opinions on co-writing. But it's not 9 out of 10 times it could be better if I've either worked for longer on it or worked with other people on it. That's all right. That's collaboration. Great.
Yeah, it's a different. It's easy to write songs. It's hard to write hits.
That's it. Yeah. That is it. And I think, and Paul and Ryan are probably telling me, saying that exact thing with their own experience. They were saying that exact thing even back then, what, eight or 9 years ago. And that was a priceless, like, mindset to be around for me. So by the end of 2012, I had a handful of songs. And this is a fun and funny story to tell. You'll understand the more inner workings of this story, as will a lot of people listening, but there'll be a lot of people who don't as well. By the end of 2012, there started to be a little bit of talk and a little bit of buzz just within the industry about me and my songs. So we did a couple of shows in London that all the major record labels came down to. The nature of the beast is this. A lot of people will do those shows, and 1 out of 10 times, there'll be this crazy frenzy of all the labels going, we've got to sign that person. The rest of the time, like it was for me, they all come down, they all walk away, and they're not at fussed, because there's lots of great music out there. And I don't know, they're looking in lots of different directions. And there was somebody at one of these...
Also, the people who are at the first shows are not really the people who can see a show and then sign that artist.
That's absolutely right.
So all
right.
Those people at all of those shows all have to like it enough that when your name's brought up at the meeting, enough people there say, no, don't skip this one yet.
And for a brand new unknown artist, that's a very hard, like, thing to achieve for those people, let alone the artist, for those people.
From your perspective, one of the hard things when you're developing an artist is getting the A-list writers.
Sure.
To even listen to it.
Sure.
In the same way, getting the A-list A&R people to listen to it.
Absolutely.
How do you get the John Green and Jamie Hartman? These are people who are sought after by artists who already have a deal.
Yeah.
How do those people get inspired enough to work on a project that isn't signed? A lot of people will hit us up and say, how do we get in the room with whoever?
Right.
It happens when it happens.
I think Paul, this will resonate with Paul and my managers, Paul and Ryan and everybody else.
Paul's
and,
here, by the way. He's way up in the stands because we're in Wembley. Yeah. So like,
but he's got us on the big screen.
Yeah,
so
he's got, right.
He can see us and he can hear us through the PA.
Yeah.
We'll wave to him. From my perspective, and I think Paul will agree, he needs this, like the manager needs this from the artist, and they obviously need to be able to do it themselves. So the question was, how does anybody, get in a room with such great writers? It goes all the way back to learn to take criticism and work harder to be better at writing songs and write great ones, because the only real thing that's going to get you into those rooms, I think, is great songs in the first place. And it's always hard. It's hard when you're not writing with that many people and maybe you're more on your own. And it's still hard to write, like we said earlier, a great song or a hit, no matter who you're writing with. So there's no sort of surefire answer or equation. But I think in all of it, as long as you're like working hard to do interesting and great stuff, sooner or later that'll get picked up by any or maybe all of the writers out there, and people will start to cotton onto it and be interested. And eventually, you can't write with everybody all at once, you know. It will come as long as you work hard, or it should do. I suppose we can't say that it will, because there's no surefire anything in this world and in this work. But I can say that much. Is that an answer?
Yeah, that's a good answer. Okay, right. So
I got to tell you in a minute how it gets all the way to Republic as well.
Yeah.
I kind of left it at all these labels didn't like me. Yeah. I don't want to leave it there because there's loads of great people at those labels. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. Loads of brilliant
but
opinions.
But do you think they didn't like you, or do you think they liked you and were like, wow, I'm a scout.
You
there's
know,
only so much I can do.
It could be that. It could be that. And it could also, Paul's agreeing big time. It could be, I just saw him like miles away, like nod his head. I saw he waved when he said that from the back of the stadium. It could be that. It could also be that those people... This is like the nature of the beast. A lot of those people could assign something recently that's similar to what I'm doing. Like, because in those early days, things can seem more similar, and because there's so much growing that any artist is yet to do, and growing to become more unique and this and that. Anyway, I did those shows. Some people were kind of into it, and the majority didn't come back with much. That's okay. If I believe in myself, which I have to, and I do, and I did, you got to keep going anyway, because I'm doing this for the love of doing it, as well as wanting to essentially kind of impress all sorts of people.
Songwriters, you could be the grand prize winner and score up to $5,000 in cash, one of 12 Martin guitars, as well as a mentoring session with El King, Joe London, or myself. The lyric winner will win an opportunity to be mentored by award-winning songwriter Tom Douglas, as well as other coveted prizes. Enter the 20th annual NSAI Song Contest presented by Martin Guitar Strings and CMT now through October 31st at nsai.cmt.com. NSAI, the National Songwriters Association International, is one of the biggest supporters of songwriters and played a major role in helping pass the Music Modernization Act, a historical piece of legislation that allows you to have a future as a songwriter. This is your opportunity to experience industry access, one-on-one mentorship with hit songwriters, and fund your creative passions. Song and lyric-only categories are open now for submissions. We can't wait to hear your songs. Today's podcast is brought to you by the musician website platform, Bandzoogle. For regular listeners of And the Writer Is, you already know you can use Bandzoogle to design a website, EPK, you know, sell your music, merch, commission-free from your website, use the tour calendar to promote your shows, collect emails from fans, send professional newsletters, yada, yada, yada. But Bandzoogle just did some new things since season four. They added fan subscriptions. So now your fans can pay a monthly fee in exchange for exclusive rewards and access to your music, giving you recurring revenue for your career. I mean, think about it. You're basically like the Taylor Swift of do-it-yourself musicians. You can now easily add any kind of content to your subscriber pages, including a blog feed, music videos, photo galleries, and more. When you want to send an update, you can simply send a messenger to subscribers using a built-in mailing list tool. And like all of the Bandzoogle sales, you know, tools, the subscriptions, all these things are commission-free. So all payments from your fans go directly into your account. So go to Bandzoogle.com and try it free for 30 days and use the promo code ATWI to get 15% off the first year of any subscription. That's Bandzoogle.com, promo code ATWI to build your website for your music.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Plus, in 2012, this is like the height of probably Teenage Dream and stuff like that. You know, like the music that you're doing isn't what everyone else is doing. So not only do people have to like it, they have to like it, and then they have to think.
Yeah, and see if they can fit it in.
And that's really hard to get people who are part of a machine to think that, well, because this is unique, that's an advantage, rather than because it's unique, it's scary. That's going to be 95% of the opinions.
That's absolutely right. The other thing I was battling against, and anybody in my position at that time would have been battling against, is it was a real hot moment for like YouTube sensation singer-songwriters, by which I mean like singer-songwriter writes song or even maybe covers a song, puts it on YouTube and overnight 500,000 plays, overnight 2 million views or plays. It was a time for that. So I think if it, or it really felt like it was a pretty strong time for that. So a lot of those people come into those shows, those A&Rs or whatever, they wanted to know if I had those kind of stats. And I did not. I did not. I was just going off trying to have a real connection with people and songs and, you know, in a moment live. So I did two of these shows and they were okay. And you know, not an enormous amount came from them, at least initially. And I went away and I thought, what else can I be doing? Because I do just want to perform. And I want to write and I want to do all of this, but I want to be performing as well. And I'd already at this point had 2 or 3 years of carting myself around, not the country, but the sort of local area, local to Brighton or local to London or even Hitchin. Those three places are about 2 hours from each other. So it's not too far. And so I was writing a lot in London at the time, lots of studios in London, writing with the likes of John and Jamie and people like that. And in the evening, because it was an expensive train ticket, if I'm honest with you, getting into London, I was trying
it's like
to make
actually like $50 to get right. from Brighton, right?
It's nuts. So, yeah. So I was trying to
quid.
There you go, nailed it. Gotcha. But you know, it all works. Yeah. I was trying to like get as much from my train ticket as I could. So I was staying in London in the evening for a few extra hours after I finished writing to find an open mic night, if there was an open mic night anywhere. And in London, there's a load. And I went to this place called the Abbey Tavern in Kentish Town, which is kind of Camden sort of area, and it's just a pub. You know, a lot of open mic nights happen in pubs, but it was a kind of a nice like stage in the window. It sort of felt like a bit of a vibe, and I got a slot, and I went up at about, I don't know, 8:30, 9 o'clock, to a room full of about 12 people. It probably could have held 100 people, but it probably had about 12 people in it because that's how it goes. It was like a Tuesday night. And I played a few songs. And during the first song, a guy walked in with a massive camera, like not a digital camera, little thing. It was like a big, like I make movies on this camera on his, like kind of, it was under his arm, but I suppose he would have worn it on his shoulder for work. And he sat down, he got himself a drink and he sat down. And in the second song, just as I was starting up the second song, he got the camera up on his shoulder and he started rolling, saw the little red light and he filmed that and he filmed the last song as well. And I got off the stage after my little three-song set and he came over and he said, I thought that was great, man. That was really cool. And I said, thanks, man. I think I saw you filming. I said, I think I saw him. It was a massive camera.
And people and there were 12 people.
Yeah, people kind of couldn't right. see for the camera. And he said, yeah. I said, it's very big. I said, what's the story with this enormous camera? How come? He said, no, I know it looks weird. I'm actually I'm a cameraman. It's my job and this is my tool for work. But he said, I'll edit this thing. I'll sort of, you know, get it into shape and I'll put it on YouTube and I'll like send you the link. I said, thanks. And we kind of carried on with our lives. And a few weeks went by and I found the link. Or he sent it to me and I clicked on it. And it had been weeks at this point. I thought, wow, fingers crossed. And it had about 23 plays.
Perfect.
Huge number, you know, the big, exciting 23 plays. But around that same time, we got a call from Republic Records in America. They had found this video.
How?
I think someone asked me this recently because I couldn't really remember initially, but if I'm to guess, it would be that even then YouTube videos had like tags, like songwriter, acoustic guitar. And I'd imagine there are people at major record labels who like search those things and one leads to another, you know, they sort of pop up. So they found it one way or another. It might've been like that. And they called us and they said, we really love this video and we love the song and we'd love to hear more, but we'd like to hear it live. We'd like to fly you to New York and meet you and maybe play us some more songs, which was just that in itself really kind of blew my mind. And talking about this in hindsight, like talking about it, remembering it, it all sounds like such a sort of Hollywood story. It sounds very kind of, and then, you know, he went around the world and all this stuff. But even at that moment, it was a terrifying experience going, you know, getting on a plane and flying to New York. I had been to New York one time with my family on vacation. It was all right. And, you know, it's being a tourist in a big, busy city is a challenge in itself. It was, you know, New York's amazing. But like, so, but to be flown back there by this label was brilliant and wonderful and absolutely terrifying because I knew at this point that a lot of the major labels in the UK weren't that fussed. And I felt like a little bit more hung on it because I knew I wanted to get signed. And I wanted to sort of go through the next steps and really try and make it like a proper record one day. But I went and I played. And there was a couple labels. There were a couple labels in the UK that were interested. And there was a little juggle eventually because I'd met them and I'd met Republic. But the guys at Republic were brilliant. They understood it all.
Yeah, and to set the stage of what this looks like for people who don't know this, you know, to go and play for 12 people, which a lot of people who listen to this know what that's like.
Sure.
Whether they're the biggest artist in the world or not, sure, they played in front of 12 people absolutely at one point or less, and or fewer, I mean. And you show up to New York after years of recording and playing, and it's Republic. When you go to this building, it's right off of Times Square. You know, it's about a few blocks away. You go up these elevators, you have to go, you check in, you go through these, you know, whatever you call those spinning gates things.
Yeah, yeah,
know,
all of that.
Yeah. So you go through, you go upstairs, and Republic's a really communal looking room. A lot of labels, you know, you have to, you don't know who's working next door.
No,
but
no.
Republic is a lot of people who can look at each other. So you walk in and immediately you can see all the different offices that have windows on one side, and then you see a pool of people who are working at the label that are all able to look at you walk through the elevators.
And look at each other as well.
And look at each other.
All the making eyes.
So it's a really, it's a, you know, I just want people to see what that looks like for somebody who's just gotten off a plane.
Yeah.
Having played mostly in small clubs.
Oh, pubs. You know, like, yeah, yeah.
In London, all the labels are really close to each other. In New York, some of them are close to each other. But when you're in that environment, it feels like being in a record label in Manhattan.
Yeah, and that's
if that makes some sense. So I think when you walk in through those doors or through that elevator, there's probably some even more expectations that, oh man, this is really real, not to mention that, you know, the artists that are coming out from Republic during the 2010s are the biggest in the world.
Massive.
So it's not like, you know, you have Taylor and you have, you know, now Ariana. Nicki Minaj. You have The Weeknd and Drake and all. I mean, it's just so many big artists. So I can imagine that being a really pressureful.
It really, really was. And there's two
and
things.
And also exciting.
Right, you this know, is like, it. Like, you as know, I, as I remember it. Yeah, no, that's perfectly accurate, all of that. And as I remember it, I'm thinking, well, what was going through my mind? And there was one thing, there was two things going through my mind. One had to go through my mind, and that was, I still believe in myself. I still believe that these people want me here. To see if they think I'm as good as they think I am. But this might sound big-headed, but you have to have a little bit of this.
Sure.
You have to have some ego. You have to have some belief that you're good.
Do you get nervous when you play?
I get very excited. I don't feel like it's nerves. There's a bit of nerves, don't get me wrong, but that isn't the overwhelming feeling. There's an adrenaline that, like, there's people out there who want to be here and it's all going to be incredible. It's going to be as incredible as I can make it. And I sound like a real Brit here because we're very modest. We're particularly kind of, you know, like, we're very self-deprecating, but or we can be. But so that's why I'm trying to okay all of this. But you have to believe in yourself. And so I don't get too nervous. So the two things that were going through my head were, I believe in myself. I can see all these people in this record label making all the eyes, and whether they're out of excitement or not, I got to deliver this. And the other thing was, you know, I was coming in with my acoustic guitar under my arm, inspired by Ray LaMontagne and Adele and, you know, that very organic, less kind of shiny pop-leaning music. And I was in the house of Taylor Swift and Drake and Nicki Minaj and, you know, very kind of punchy, powerful pop. And I really wanted to be there. And I still love it. I've got to be honest with you. The most exciting thing for me about signing to Republic is that they are this like superpower monster label. And they want me to do my thing in their house so that they can kind of be a part of it. And that the adrenaline that gave me, the excitement that gave me kind of fueled me as well. I wanted to be unique in that environment.
So you obviously signed to Republic.
And I signed to, I signed to Republic.
So it worked out. So then when you have, you do this record deal, biggest label in the world, you have some songs at this point.
Right.
How much of Chaos and the Calm was written by the time you were signed?
When I signed the deal, I hadn't written Let It Go and I hadn't written Hold Back the River.
Okay.
And those two songs off Chaos and the Calm really kind of carried that album, which I'm very proud to say. But the interesting and exciting, and I guess I'm not even being biased, the wonderful thing about Republic is they heard Move Together and When We Were on Fire, those songs I wrote with Jamie Hartman and John Green. And my new song at that time that I'd just written was a song called Get Out While You Can, which was kind of a very Bruce Springsteen sort of vibe. And I stood and played it for them on an acoustic guitar. It was like a Bruce Springsteen meets Kings of Leon kind of vibe that is the way I recorded that song and we produced that song. But I was just doing it with my acoustic guitar just like as honestly as I possibly could. And I remember Avery and Monty and the rest of the label just really... It's nice to say that they were like, they were moved by the experience. It did matter what songs I had, and I was in there because they wanted to hear like those songs, and they wanted to hear some potential, I guess. But they have always given me a lot of room to grow.
How long did it take you to write those songs?
Which one?
After Let It Go and Hold Back the River?
Let It Go.
Those
came,
are huge records.
Thanks, so. Man. Let It Go came in. I signed in February 2013. I think it was... I like to try and remember these dates, but I can't.
Yeah, that'd be weird.
Nobody usually does. And I signed in February and I wrote Let It Go like April or May. And I wrote Hold Back the River after I had spent the first 2 weeks making Chaos and the Calm. I started making Chaos and the Calm in Nashville with Jakir King for 2 weeks. And I went home... at the end of October, and then in November I did a load of touring in the UK, and I opened up for a band called Codaline, and then at the end of that tour, the night after that, I had a headline show, my first headline show in the basement of a pub to about 100 people. And yeah, I kind of built myself up to that night, and I was also really excited to like celebrate this year that I'd had with all the people who came to that show. It was like my family and friends,
sure.
And like four new fans. And I was going to celebrate this night. It was going to be wonderful. And it all came and went. And I went home. And the next day I had to fly off and go somewhere else. And I didn't get to see any of my friends and family properly. And Hold Back the River ended up being a lot about that, about the kind of whirlwind experience being wonderful, but also kind of difficult because you don't get to be present and connected with all your most important people.
Sure.
But yeah, so I wrote that the next day. And then I went back in December to do some more recording. And in Nashville, making Chaos and the Calm. And I went back with Hold Back the River.
Paul Berry, your co-writer.
Yeah, on Let It Go, yeah.
On Let It Go. That guy's a legend.
That guy's, yeah, that he's...
Like, that's such a huge name, and it's just not a huge name in the U.S., but, I mean...
He did write Hero for Enrique Iglesias.
Yeah.
And he did write...
Vayamos.
Right, and he wrote... what was
I did,
it?
He did... Do you believe
yes, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, the guy's,
the
guy's like, a legend.
The guy knows what he's doing.
Most of your co-writes are with one other person.
Yeah.
Is that by design?
No. I'll be honest. I mean, I do like that one-on-one experience and connection, but I have written with multiple folks.
In LA, there's a vibe of let's get, you know, we need to have at least three, and that'll go to four or five, sometimes more. And sometimes it's fun, and it's supposed to be fun.
I bet.
If you can just view it as like today's just for fun,
yeah,
then you might just get a great song from it.
Yeah.
You know, there are a lot of songs. Yeah. Joe, who's in this room, had, you know, two or three hits that came from a group of people that were just having a lot of fun in the room. But also, there is, there's an intimacy when it's one on one that you get this left to center kind of music. Cause,
and as I moved like into writing, really, you know, 2011, 12, 13, 14, it was a big kind of growing period for my writing, and it always just felt easier, maybe even a bit better when it was sort of one-on-one, but I don't mind it when it's two. I don't know if I've really written with when it's been more than three people in the room. I don't think I've done one like that. I can't remember, but one-on-one always felt good. And like speaking of Paul Barry and when we wrote Let It Go, for me, the writing experience, the co-writing experience, can sometimes be extremely collaborative. And sometimes, in honesty, I have something I'm trying to say and I have a slightly more clear idea of what I'm trying to create. And the other person in the room is like a great like buffer or filter and kind of like metaphorically kind of sits in the corner, sometimes quite literally sits in the corner, just like with one ear on what I'm doing and kind of helps me along. I might look up when I think I've got the verse and go, what do you think? And they might go, nah.
But that's a good co-writer.
It's a great co-writer.
You know, like not all, you know, if two people in a room and you have to contribute 50%.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes if that person contributes 45%, but it's worth 55%.
That's it. That's
of the information, like that can be worth it too. They don't necessarily have to be the one who's writing all the melodies and lyrics in order for them to be a good.
And in honesty, co-writer. Sometimes I walk in with an emotion or a feeling, and especially like sometimes with John Green, and this is probably because we're so close in all of this, he's great at leading it.
Yeah.
I'm going, well, I'm feeling this. And he's coming up with phenomenal melodies that I'm chipping in on.
Yeah.
But he's, you know, he might be leading the sort of musical charge and all based on me talking about how I'm feeling about a thing. So it works in all different ways. And it can be like that with three people in the room. And I just don't have the experience of more than three of us in the room. But
so
it varies.
The music comes out and it's wildly successful. Let It Go in particular in the US just... You know, so that's more my experience
sure,
with the song.
Sure, man, yeah.
But everywhere it's huge.
Yeah, it's very cool.
It goes so much faster than you can tour.
Absolutely.
You can't possibly be in Australia and in the UK and in the US and the rest of the world all at once. You tried.
We tried.
Yeah, you did your best.
We tried.
What does it feel like to be on that kind of roller coaster? How were you mentally dealing with that? Did you mentally deal with it?
Great questions. Did I mentally deal with it? I think I did okay. I like to think I kind of went with the flow as much as possible. But boy, was I learning very much on the job, like every day, and learning about when to throw more of my opinion in or more of how I felt and when not to, and when to let everybody else just sort of run, you know, steer the ship and run the show. And looking back now, even from where I am today, I've still got learning to do and I've still got work to do on those fronts. But how did I deal with it? As best I could. And I talk to different artists as much as I can about their experience. And everybody deals with it different. I think, I don't know. I know obviously I sort of got through it but arguably I'm still on the ride, you know, and it'll change and evolve as time goes on as long as I keep working and writing. But I feel proud of that time.
I mean, you went from playing for 100 people, your closest allies.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure there's a difference between that and Glastonbury.
Oh, man. Just a little.
But there've got to be some parts that are really similar and mean different. Like, there've got to be some parts of performing in front of 100 people that matter that is somehow difficult mentally in a way that playing in front of 60,000 or
right.
I don't know, some stupid number.
It's a crazy number. Yeah.
Whatever it is. You know, I mean, we could go, there's so many fun things that happen during this time.
I mean,
before we even get to the Grammys and the Brits and all that,
you
play with the Rolling Stones. I think that's before that, right?
The wildest thing that as a fan of the Rolling Stones is that, and again, my modest British self is like tearing me to pieces inside. Yeah. But
this is the worst podcast for that.
Oh, I know. I know. But I can sit here and say
I'll keep making
That was the first time I played with the Stones. And there was a second time in 2018. They were very different, those occasions. I have to be kind of clear and honest. 2013, they played in Hyde Park and they had a string of acts open up for them and they supposedly, you know, sort of called everybody up. Not called everybody up, but, you know, they asked everybody along and the Stones went on at like 8 p.m. and played till 10:30 and were phenomenal, even, you know, in 2013. And I probably went on at like 1 p.m. in the afternoon. But the craziest thing for me is that there was a poster all around London that said the Rolling Stones and it had like Jake Bugg and a couple of other like great openers. And at the bottom of the poster was my name and I shared the poster.
yeah,
with the Stones, and it was wild. And then in 2018, last year, they invited us to open for them in Twickenham, in a stadium like this one, in London. And we got to keep it up. There you go.
Yeah, keep going.
I got to, you know, come into contact with one of my favorite bands and definitely one of the greatest bands of all time for a second time.
Yeah. And this time it says like Rolling Stones and James
Bay.
Opening, yeah, right.
Wild.
After.
And they
yeah.
invited me up on stage. We sang Beast of Burden. It was the craziest experience of my life.
Do you call them Mick and Keith?
Yeah.
Do they text you?
Yeah.
No. True?
Not Keith. I don't think Keith gives a damn about
Keith
cell
doesn't
phones.
Know what a phone is, right?
And that's great. Yeah. He doesn't need to.
Yeah.
He
he's need sending to, a but, pigeon. Or an owl.
Right.
Or
I hope
like
so.
He's
yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Like,
yeah, he's like, he yeah. I mean, you know, the love and support that I felt from those guys is still quite impossible to fathom. We did three nights at Brixton Academy in 2015, which is a really like well sought after venue in London and in the UK. And Ronnie came and did a song with us. Ronnie Wood came up and did a song with us on one of those nights. And I boldly decided to ask him, and he kindly said, I'd love to. So Ronnie once sent me a, he wasn't sure if I'd got a text. Because he'd sent it from one of the, whether it was an iPad or a Mac or a phone. So he sent me a text, which he had taken a picture of the text on his iPad screen with his iPhone and texted me the picture of the text from his iPhone.
Classic.
That was the greatest moment ever.
Classic old man.
And there were so many fantastic emojis. It was a colorful text. It was great.
That's something I would do.
And that, I can't believe I'm even saying that to you. I really can't. It's nuts.
You have, I mean, obviously we all know the success of, I guess we don't all know, the album's super successful. You get a bunch of Grammy nominees. You know, for the Americans, that's huge. Brits, Ivor Novello's probably the biggest.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
no.
Just stupid kind of accolades.
Nuts.
Was there any pressure in following up that, and were you able to enjoy the aftermath of it? Or was there, like, when you've had that kind of year after, you know, two straight years of pushing an album and singles that are reacting, is there a moment where you just were like, oh, I'm going to go on vacation?
There was 10 days.
Okay.
Yes, there was 10 days.
You still remember them. What did you do?
No, they were fine. Those 10 days were fine, but they were okay. I was just super hungry to make more music. My only experience of releasing an album was Chaos in the Calm. So, you know, there was massive pressure. Absolutely. There was definitely pressure. And some of that I put on myself, some of that I felt from elsewhere. It's never not going to be like that when your first record or a record that you've released does those wonderful things. But I had the greatest time. I had the greatest time making my second record.
More involved in the production.
Way
at least,
more, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I way more involved in all of that. And I ended up sharing almost the entire experience, like 8 or 9 out of 10, or 80 or 90% of it was me and John Green, who, like I've already said, is just a great, great friend and a brilliant, brilliant bloke and a brilliant musician and writer. And we did pretty much all of it together. I did write a song on that record with Jimmy Napes, who's a phenomenal writer and a great guy. And I was really proud of that. And it felt kind of ready to a lot of us. And it had really just been John and I putting it together and producing it. And Rob at the label had a sort of a chance opportunity when he was sat down with Paul Epworth to show him some of the stuff. I'm a massive, massive fan of Paul. Always have been, or at least, well, I say always, definitely around what he was doing with Adele, like so many of us, when he started to have that great success with Adele's second record. And I know he'd done great things with bands like Block Party in the past before that. So he's always done brilliant, exciting things. And he heard some of these songs that John and I had put together for the second album. And he called me. He called me up and he said, I've heard your music and I think it's brilliant. And he said, I think you could put it out. But I know that you're not in a great rush, and I know that you're sort of biding your time and making sure it's finished. And he said, if I may, can I take this opportunity and see if you want to mess around with some of it at my studio? He's got this brilliant studio called The Church in Crouch End in London. And what an offer. I was like, I was kind of blown away by this like production hero and kind of modern day legend, like coming in and asking if I wanted to work on some of the stuff I'd already created with him. So we spent, me and John went and spent a few weeks with Paul, and we kind of tinkered and messed around and really improved a lot of it and brought it to life again. And suddenly we got Paul Epworth, included in the experience. And I had the greatest time making the second record. And like, all of it's intentional. You know, I wanted to go somewhere else, do something a bit different, evolve and change as an artist, and obviously try and hold on to some of the things that are so instinctively and innately me, musically. And it's all part of the journey. You know, it's a chapter, and it was a lot of fun, and I'm excited to, obviously, you know, I got to work with Julia Michaels and who I was always a fan of, and had been signed to Republic as well for a couple of years. And, you know, as you'll know, lots of artists and writers, we're never in the same town,
right?
The same place at the same time. And eventually we were. Julia and I have met, and then about a year later, we finally got time to work together. And we've written a few times, but this newest song, Peer Pressure, was the first thing we wrote together. So yeah, everything
she's,
that came
she
after...
She says hi, by the way.
She says hi.
Yeah.
Say hi back.
Oh well,
she's amazing. We wrote Peer Pressure was the first thing that we wrote together, but it was just very cool to sort of get to.
That's not on the album, though.
No, that's not so Electric Light. No,
is there a? Are you done with Electric Light as far as promoting at this point?
Yeah,
and then
I suppose.
Is the thought process, let's now release singles? Or is it not really a thought process and it's like, this is a really good song with my friend.
Yeah.
Let's release this because this is 2019 and you can just decide to do that now.
You've nailed it. Peer pressure is that. And I mean, I'm touring. We just did 5 weeks in the States and it was the Electric Light Tour, and we played a load of songs off Electric Light, and we played stuff with Chaos and the Calm, and we played Peer Pressure, and I even threw a new song in. So...
Ooh, what's a new song?
Well, all of that, I'm very proud of this new song. I wrote it with Dan Wilson.
Oh, nice.
It's called Bad, and it's really cool. But
also our friend, Dan Wilson.
What a man.
Yeah.
That dude blows me away.
Yeah.
His Instagram account is incredible.
Yeah.
It's like the most zen, like wizard Instagram
account.
He's
the best calligrapher in the music business.
Right.
He's incredible.
What you were saying about just reacting to what you can do in 2019 and how you can release music is where I'm at. And I'm really enjoying that. But I also, I feel like an album artist. Whatever is happening with albums, I feel like my fans want albums. I'm an album artist in that respect, and I love albums. I love that body of work, that collection.
Yeah.
So I'm recognizing that, and I'm working with that as well. There will be albums. There will always be albums.
Well,
when
you think of where you started with parents that listen to... One that listens to rock music, one that listens to soul. You're like, those are both genres that are truly album genres.
Big time.
And so it's hard to envision only releasing singles and having someone ever get identity of
That's
an artist
very
from
true.
It. You'd have to release so many singles, and then you're putting so much pressure on the listener to stitch together the human.
That's where the album track, we call it the album track, but like that's where that seems extremely important.
Yeah,
Because it's for the listener. It's like, oh, this is another thing that they were thinking around this time, and another thing that they were feeling around the time of making this music. You know, because so much, like you say, so much pressure is loaded onto the point of the single and what it's saying and how it sounds and all of that.
But you still have to feel some of that pressure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. But you, I think a lot of us have more music that we want to make than just a single's worth. Even if you release 5 singles in 4 months or whatever, there's more. There's always more. You know, music can come quick sometimes and in kind of boatloads. So, and some of that stuff's good.
Did you ever want to write for other people?
That's still...
I mean, you have some cuts, right?
Yeah.
People covered stuff?
Yeah, people have covered stuff. I know that I know that Kygo used a song that I wrote. I'm forgetting actually. There's a few different like things that have sort of seeped and bled out there and that I've been a part of writing. But I suppose my feeling still towards that is I've got like stuff I want to prove about myself as a musician and things I want to say. And
absolutely.
So, but I do, to answer your question in a word, yes, I would like to do more of that. I'm just, I guess I'm trying to find time.
What happens to you in the next couple of years?
Oh man.
What's your dream scenario?
I would really like to keep being able to tour around the world and, like, you know, sell out shows. Like, I'd like to do that. God, if I'm honest with you, I'd like to be on the radio. I'd like to keep doing what I've been able to do for the last 4 or 5 years in some capacity for the rest of my life, let alone the next 3 or 4 yeah. years or whatever, which
you,
I know is bold.
You want the Rolling Stones grandkids yes, to open for you.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, oh, I mean, that
or
would be
them
wild.
Open for you or go and keep playing yeah. with them.
I thought you were going to say just achieve what the Rolling Stones achieved and oh, everybody wants that. I mean, that would be amazing. But I just want to be able to keep doing it.
Do you have a personal life?
Yes, I have a very personal life.
How? When?
Sometimes. Yeah. I don't know. I do. I have Lucy, my girlfriend, at home. We've been together for 11 years.
Oh, amazing.
And we're great. And and it's a wild ride, but I've been able to be on it with her the whole time.
Shout out to Lucy.
Massive shout
out to
Lucy.
Is she in music?
She was. No, she's very creative, though. She works in ceramics and all that. Yeah, I want to be able to tour. I want to be able to keep coming to America to tour. I have to say, I have a very good time doing that. And then hopefully go around the rest of the world, you know, as well, like I've been able to do for the last few years.
All right, well, let's go to this next segment. It's 5 for 5.
5 for 5, okay.
There's probably a better title, as we've discussed for 50-something episodes. I'm going to just list 5 names, and you're going to tell me the first thing that comes out the top
All
of
right,
your head.
Here we go.
Alex, your brother.
Oh man, he's just like, he's like a whole part of me, like physically and spiritually. He's one of the biggest and mainest reasons that I got into doing this. I needed him. I realized more than ever in hindsight that I needed him. We went in together into this. We walked like out into the world being musical together. And even though I went off on my own, I couldn't probably have done that without starring next to him.
Tom, your bassist.
Actually the same answer, because I've known Tom since I was probably 2 years old. He's a brother. He's family. You know, it was me and Alex, and it was Tom. It was the three of us.
It must be so weird to be on stage with someone you've known since you're two and be like, how are these people still listening to us? Like, it's gotta feel
absolutely wild there. Really nuts.
Strange.
But this is kind of the same answer for Tom.
Yeah. Well, then let's just keep going on these people that's going to say the same one. It's got to be John Green. You got to have a similar,
It is the same. But in a slightly different way, John has taught me so much about writing. Lots of people have taught me lots about writing, but John, we've dug in pretty deep over the years on all different sort of subjects surrounding music and life, and he is right there. What a companion. Great dude. Definitely the funniest person I've ever met.
Yeah, he's very funny. I think I worked with him and Lucy Silvis, you know?
Lucy? Oh yeah, amazing. Yeah. Lucy and John go back a long way. They were kids when they first met. Yeah.
Yeah, let's give Lucy another shout out. I mean, I know Lucy, you just did, but
Like that's almost hard to put into words. Like she's kept me alive.
Yeah.
I think she still does. Like she's vital.
Yeah, a good relationship if you're an artist, to have somebody that's probably the best co-writer you have.
Oh my God.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
no one
ever really talks about it, but anybody who's in a relationship who's an artist knows that, you know, I joke about it with my wife, but it's like, for sure, you know, there are times where she's like, well, do I get any writing credit for that one? And I'm like, well, I mean, you know, you get 50%.
And it's a full spiritual
that's gotta
credit.
It's got to count for something.
Paul and Ryan, my managers, will really kind of understand that one too, because she's actually she kind of makes the square in a way. There's the four of us, like in terms of like how work goes, she can be really vital to it in an enormous way. And over the years as well, you know, yeah, I'll say that.
I'm going to do two more if that's okay. That makes it 6
sure,
for 6.
That's fine. 6 for 6.
Is that okay, guys? Okay. Let's do Julia Michaels.
Julia Michaels. Julia, like, because she's this incredible writer, but she's this incredible artist. I saw her perform the other night. She was very kind and invited me up when she was opening for Pink at the Staples Center, we got up and did Peer Pressure. So I've really experienced her fully as an artist now, as well as mainly beforehand experiencing her as a writer. And she's obviously very young in this whole experience. She's only like in her early 20s, and she's achieved so much. So she's totally wise beyond her years. And we both meet brilliant writers who've been doing this for all sorts of numbers of years. But to find somebody so so talented and successful so young, with such a wise head on her shoulders, she's taught me, even in the time I've known her, a lot about, I guess, what I want to do going forward and how I want to be as an artist and a writer. So pretty indispensable.
She's a huge heart.
Yeah,
she's
like, big time.
Okay. Let's finish on your management, not just because half of them are here right now. But let's finish with the, you know, because they were there from the show, from Brighton.
And you know, I've met all sorts of artists, as have you, as has Paul, who go through different managers and managers that go through different artists. And it's a little bit how I am. The reason why Paul and Ryan and I still work together nearly 10 years later, it's definitely about how I am. I'm a loyal person, and I love relationships that grow over time, you know, professionally in work and in everything else. I love that. I'm all about that journey. But God, they've taught me like so much. And I think one of the things I appreciate the most is the courage, actually, from their perspective, to go, yeah, that's not good enough. That needs to be better. That's priceless. That's absolutely priceless. So many artists kind of come into this like, okay, great. And they kind of rub their hands together and go, when's the first theater, arena, stadium? When's the first private jet, this, that, you know, where's the numbers, when's the first hit single? I've thought those kind of things like everybody else has, but you need level heads on shoulders from the likes of Paul and Ryan to go, all that stuff's on the way, but let's just focus on right now. And like, how good is the song? And how good is the performance? And could it be better? It could always be better. So let's just keep working for that. And you can say that in passing, but to kind of ingrain that into somebody's psyche is a difficult thing to do, but a vital, extremely important thing to do.
What's advice you'd give to an up-and-coming writer and maybe even a British up-and-coming writer?
A British up-and-coming writer? I'd say the same thing to a British up-and-coming writer that I would say to an American or up-and-coming writer or anybody from all over the world. Do as much listening as you can from all corners of music and the world. Listen, soak up as much as you can. And you know, take as much of that into account when you are creating it as you can. Now, that sounds like a big ask, but what I really mean is keep a very open mind. Anything, you know, anything could go anywhere. And like you were saying when you were talking about having a room full of writers for some sessions, have as much fun with it as you can. Do it from the heart, you know?
Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
When you were releasing new music and you were playing at SNL,
yeah,
and you did Wild Love, I remember that being something that we were really excited, me and my wife, we're excited to see what the next music would be.
Sure.
I can't name five artists that I cared to listen to see where they go.
That means the world, man.
So before we ever met, I was excited.
Thank you.
To see your progress. I'm impressed with it so far. No, it's just starting.
Thanks, man.
We'll do this again after the next three albums and you come back, you're like, whoa.
Well, check this out.
And it's going to be no way. And we're actually going to do this at Wembley.
That's what we should
do. That's what we should, in three albums, that's our goal. Our goal is to actually somehow do this.
All right. We're going to shake
the middle
on that right
of
now.
Wembley. And just so we can do it, even if it's like an update, we just need to do it. When next time you're playing, we'll just be there and we'll go just to do 15 minutes and say, this is crazy. But I'm proud of you, even though we're just meeting. And thank you again. And excited to see what's next.
Thank you so much, man. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silberstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.